7. I could ride my bike most of the way there. Adobe Road empty of cars, except for the occasional motorcycle or horse trailer. If a car passed, it was usually heading to the ranch, and they'd give me a lift, my bicycle half hanging out a window. Girls in shorts and wood sandals and plastic rings from the dispensers outside the Rexall. Boys who kept losing their train of thought, then coming to with a stunned smile, as if returned from cosmic tourism. The barest of nods we'd give one another, tuned to the same unseen frequencies. It wasn't that I couldn't remember my life before Suzanne and the others, but it had been limited and expected, objects and people occupying their temperate orbits. The yellow cake my mother made for birthdays, dense and chilly from the freezer. The girls at school eating lunch on the asphalt, sitting on their overturned backpacks. Since I'd met Suzanne, my life had come into sharp, mysterious relief, revealing a world beyond the known world, the hidden passage behind the bookcase. I'd catch myself eating an apple, and even the wet swallow of apple could incite gratitude in me. The arrangement of oak leaves overhead, condensing with a hothouse clarity, clues to a riddle I hadn't known you could try to solve. I followed Suzanne past the motorcycles parked at the front of the main house, as big and heavy-looking as cows. Men in denim vests sat on the nearby boulders, smoking cigarettes. The air was prickly from the llamas in their pen, the funny smell of hay and sweat and sun-baked shit. "Hey, bunnies," one of the men called, stretching so his belly strained pregnant against his shirt. Suzanne smiled back, but pulled me along. "If you stand around too much, they'll jump on you," she said, though she was pushing her shoulders back to emphasize her breasts. When I caught a glance over my shoulder, the man flicked his tongue at me, quick as a snake. "Russell can help all kinds of people, though," Suzanne said. "And you know, the pigs don't mess with the motorcycle guys. That's important." "Why?" "Because," she said, like it was obvious, "the cops hate Russell. They hate anyone who tries to free people from the system. But they stay away if those guys are here." She shook her head. "The pigs are trapped, too. That's the bullshit. Their fucking shiny black shoes." I stoked my own righteous agreement. I was in league with truth. I followed her to the clearing beyond the house, toward the campfire hum of voices in chorus. The money was banded tightly in my pocket, and I kept starting to tell Suzanne I'd brought it, then losing my nerve, concerned it was too meager an offering. Finally, I stopped her, touching her shoulder before we joined the others. "I can get more," I said, flustered. I just wanted her to know the money existed, imagining I would be the one to give it to Russell. But Suzanne quickly corrected that idea. I tried not to mind how swiftly she took the bills from my hand, counting them with her eyes. I saw that she was surprised by the amount. "Good girl." The sun hit the tin outbuildings and broke up the smoke in the air. Someone had lit a joss stick that kept going out. Russell's eyes moved around each of our faces, the group sitting at his feet, and I flushed when he caught my gaze. He seemed unsurprised by my return. Suzanne's hand touched my back lightly, possessively, and a hush came over me like in a movie theater or church. My awareness of her hand was almost paralyzing. Donna was playing with her orange hair, weaving sections into tight, lacy braids, using her pinched fingernails to flay split ends. Russell looked younger when he sang, his mess of hair tied back, and he played the guitar in a funny, mocking way, like a TV cowboy. His voice wasn't the nicest I'd ever heard, but that day, my legs in the sun, the stubble of oat grass. That day, his voice seemed to slide all over me, to saturate the air, so that I felt pinned in place. I couldn't move even if I wanted to, even if I could imagine there was any place I could go. In the lull that followed Russell's singing, Suzanne got to her feet, her dress already thick with dust, and picked her way to his side. His face changed as she whispered to him, and he nodded, squeezing her shoulder. I saw her slip him my wad of money, which Russell put in his pocket, resting his fingers there for a moment, as if giving a blessing. Russell's eyes crinkled. "We've got good news. We've got some resources, sweethearts, because someone has opened themselves up to us. They've opened their hearts." A shimmer passed through me, and all at once it seemed worth it, trawling my mother's purse, the stillness of Teddy's parents' bedroom. How cleanly that worry had been transmuted into belonging. Suzanne seemed gratified as she hurried to settle back beside me. "Little Evie's shown us her big heart," Russell said. "She's shown us her love, hasn't she?" And the others turned to look at me. A current of goodwill pulsed in my direction. The rest of the afternoon passed in a drowsy span of sunlight, the skinny dogs retreating under the house, tongues heaving. We sat alone on the porch steps. Suzanne rested her head on my knees and recounted scraps of a dream she'd had, pausing to take ripping bites from a length of French bread. "I was convinced I knew sign language, but it was obvious to me I didn't, that I was just flailing my hands around. But the man understood everything I was saying, like I actually did know sign language. But later, it just turned out he was only pretending to be deaf," she said. "In the end. So it was all fake. Him, me, the whole train." Her laugh was an afterthought, a sharp addendum. How happy I was for any news of her interior, a secret meant for me alone. I couldn't say how long we sat there, the two of us cut adrift from the rhythms of normal life. But that's what I wanted, for even time to feel different and new, washed with special import, like she and I were occupying the same song. We were, Russell told us, starting a new kind of society. Free from racism, free from exclusion, free from hierarchy. We were in service of a deeper love. That's how he said it, a deeper love. His voice booming from the ramshackle house in the California grasslands, and we played together like dogs, tumbling and biting and breathless with sun shock. We were barely adults, most of us, and our teeth were still milky and new. We ate whatever was put in front of us. Oatmeal that gummed up in the throat. Ketchup on bread. Chipped beef from a can. Potatoes, soggy with Pam. "Miss 1969, Suzanne called me. "Our very own." And they treated me like that. Like their new toy. Taking turns, hooking their arms through mine, clamoring to braid my long hair, teasing me about the boarding school I'd mentioned, my famous grandmother, whose name some of them recognized, my clean white socks. The others had been with Russell for months, or years even, and that was the first worry that the days slowly melted in me. Where were their families, girls like Suzanne? Or baby-voiced Helen. She spoke sometimes of a house in Eugene. A father who gave her enemas every month and rubbed her calves after tennis practice with mentholated balm, among other dubious hygienic practices. But where was he? If any of their homes had given them what they needed, why would they be here, day after day, their time at the ranch stretching on endlessly. Suzanne slept late, barely up by noon, groggy and lingering, her movements at half speed, like there would always be more time. By then, I was already sleeping in Suzanne's bed every few nights. Her mattress wasn't comfortable, gritty with sand, but I didn't mind. Sometimes she reached over blindly from sleep to sling her arm around me, a warmth coming off her body like baked bread. I would lie awake, painfully alert to Suzanne's nearness. She turned in the night, so she kicked off the sheet, exposing her bare breasts. Her room was dark and jungly in the mornings, the tar roof of the outbuilding getting bubbly in the heat. I was already dressed, but knew we wouldn't join the others for another hour. Suzanne always took a long time to get ready, though preparation was mostly a matter of time and not action, a slow shrug into herself. I liked to watch her from the mattress, the sweet, blank way she studied her reflection with the directionless gaze of a portrait. Her naked body was humble at these moments, even childish, bent at an unflattering angle as she rummaged through the trash bag of clothes. It was comforting to me, her humanness, noticing how her ankles were gruff with stubble or the pin dots of blackheads. Suzanne had been a dancer in San Francisco. The flashing neon snake outside the club, the red apple that cast an alien glow on the passers-by. One of the other girls burned off Suzanne's moles backstage with a caustic pencil. "Some girls hated being up there," she said, tugging a dress over her nakedness. "Dancing, the whole thing. But I didn't think it was so bad." She assessed the dress in the mirror, cupping her breasts through the fabric. "People can be so prudish," she said. She made a lewd face, laughing a little at herself, and let her breasts drop. She told me then how Russell fucked her gently, and how sometimes he didn't, and how you could like it either way. "There's nothing sick about that," she said. "The people who act so uptight, who act like it's so evil, they're the real perverts. It's like some of the guys who'd come to see us dance, all mad at us that they were there, like we tricked them." Suzanne didn't often talk about her hometown or family, and I didn't ask. There was a glossy pucker of scar tissue along one of her wrists that I'd seen her tracing with a tragic pride, and once she slipped and mentioned a humid street outside Red Bluff. But then she caught herself. "That cunt," she called her mother, peaceably. My dizzy solidarity overwhelmed me, the weary justice in her tone. I thought we both knew what it was to be alone, though it seems silly to me now, to think we were so alike, when I had grown up with housekeepers and parents, and she told me she had sometimes lived in a car, sleeping in the reclined passenger seat with her mother in the driver's side. If I was hungry, I ate. But we had other things in common, Suzanne and I, a different hunger. Sometimes I wanted to be touched so badly, I was scraped by longing. I saw the same thing in Suzanne, too, perking up like an animal smelling food whenever Russell approached. Suzanne went into San Rafael with Russell to look at a truck. I stayed behind. There were chores, and I threw myself into them with an eagerness born of fear. I didn't want to give them any excuse to make me leave. Feeding the llamas, weeding the garden, scrubbing and bleaching the kitchen floors. Work was just another way to show your love, to offer up the self. Filling the llama's trough took a long time, the water pressure sluggish at best. but it was nice to be out in the sun. Mosquitoes hovered around my bare skin, and I kept having to shiver them off. They didn't bother the llamas, who just stood there, as sultry and heavy-lidded as screen sirens. I could see Guy beyond the main house, messing with the bus engine with the low-stakes curiosity of a science fair project, taking breaks to smoke cigarettes and do downward dog. He went to the main house every once in a while to get another beer from Russell's stash, checking to make sure everyone did their chores. He and Suzanne were like the head counselors, keeping Donna and the others in line with a stray word or glance, operating as satellite versions of Russell, though Guy's deference was different from Suzanne's. I think he stayed around because Russell was a way to get things he wanted. Girls, drugs, a place to crash. He wasn't in love with Russell, didn't cower or pant in his presence. Guy was more like a sidekick, and all his blustery tales of adventure and hardship continued to star himself. He approached the fence, his beer and cigarette in the same hand, his jeans low on his hips. I knew he was watching me, and I concentrated on the hose, the warm fill of water in the trough. "The smoke keeps him away," Guy said, and I turned, as if I'd just noticed his presence. "The mosquitoes," he said, holding out his cigarette. "Yeah," I said. "Sure. Thanks." I took the cigarette over the fence, careful to keep the hose trained on the trough. "You seen Suzanne?" Already, Guy assumed I'd know her movements. I was flattered to be the keeper of her whereabouts. "Some guy in San Rafael was selling his truck," I said. "She went with Russell to look at it." "Hmm," Guy said, reaching to take his cigarette back. He seemed amused by my professionalism, though I'm sure he saw, too, the worship that hijacked my face whenever I spoke of Suzanne. My half-hitched step, those times I hurried to her side. Maybe it confused him not to be the focus of all that desire. He was a handsome boy, used to the attention of girls. Girls who sucked in their stomachs when he put his hand down their jeans. Girls who believed the jewelry he wore was the pretty evidence of his untapped emotional depths. "They're probably at the free clinic," Guy said. He mimed, scratching his crotch, his cigarette waving around. He was trying to get me to snicker at Suzanne, collude in some way. I didn't respond beyond a grim smile. He tilted back on the heels of his cowboy boots, studying me. "You can go on and help Ruse," he said, in between the final slugs of his beer. "She's in the kitchen." I'd already finished my chores for the day, and working with Ruse in the hot kitchen would be tedious, but I nodded with a martyr's air. Ruse had been married to a policeman in Corpus Christi, Suzanne had told me, which seemed about right. She floated around the border with the dreamy solitude of beaten wives, and even my offer of help with the dishes was met with a mild cower. I scrubbed gelatinous fug from their biggest stew pot, the colorless scraps of food gumming up the sponge. Guy was punishing me in his petty fashion, but I didn't care. Any irritation was softened by Suzanne's return. She gusted into the kitchen, breathless. "The guy gave Russell the truck," Suzanne said, her face bright, casting around for an audience. She opened a cabinet, rooting inside. "It was so perfect," she said, "'cause he wanted, like, $200. And Russell said, all calm, 'You should just give it to us.'" She laughed, still residually thrilled, and sat up on the counter, starting to crack her way through a bag of dusty-looking peanuts. The guy was real angry at first that Russell was just asking for it, for free. Ruse was only half listening, picking through the makings of that night's dinner, but I turned off the faucet, watching Suzanne with my whole body. "And Russell said, 'Let's just talk for a minute. Just let me tell you what I'm about.' Suzanne spit a shell back into the bag. We had some tea with the guy in his weird log cabin house for an hour or something. Russell gave him the whole vision, laid it all out. And the guy was real interested in what we were doing out here. Showed Russell his old army pictures. Then he said we could just have the truck. I wiped my hands on my shorts, her giddiness making me so shy I had to turn away. I finished the dishes to the sound of her snapping open peanut after peanut from her perch on the counter, amassing an unruly pile of damp shells until the bag was gone and she went looking for someone else to tell her story to. The girls would hang out near the creek because it was cooler, the breeze carrying a chill, though the flies were bad. The rocks capped with algae, the sleepy shade. Russell had come back from town in the new truck, bearing candy bars, comic books whose pages grew limp from our hands. Helen ate her candy immediately and looked around at the rest of us with a seethe of jealousy. Though she'd also come from a wealthy family, we weren't close. I found her dull, except around Russell, when her brattiness took on a directed aim. Preening under his touch like a cat, she acted younger even than me, stunted in a way that would later seem pathological. "Jesus, stop staring at me," Suzanne said, hunching her candy away from Helen. "You already ate yours." Her shape on the bank next to me, her toes curling into the dirt, jerking when a mosquito swarmed by her ear.
"Just a bite," Helen whined. "Just the corner."
Ruse glanced up from the chambray mess of cloth in her lap. She was mending a work shirt for Guy, her tiny stitches made with absent precision.
"You can have some of mine," Donna said, "if you be quiet."
She picked her way to Helen, her chocolate bar craggy with peanuts. Helen took a bite. When she giggled, her teeth washed with chocolate.
"Candy yoga," she pronounced.
Anything could be yoga. Doing the dishes, grooming the llamas, making food for Russell. You were supposed to bliss out on it, to settle into whatever the rhythms were going to teach you. Break down the self. Offer yourself up like dust to the universe. All the books made it sound like the men forced the girls into it. That wasn't true, not all the time. Suzanne wielded her swinger camera like a weapon, goading men to drop their jeans, to expose their penises, tender and naked in dark nests of hair. The men smiled shyly in the pictures, paled from the guilty flash, all hair and wet animal eyes.
"There isn't any film in the camera," Suzanne would say,
though she had stolen a case of film from the store. The boys pretended to believe her. It was like that with lots of things. I trailed after Suzanne, after all of them. Suzanne letting me draw suns and moons on her naked back with tanning oil, while Russell played an idle riff on his guitar, a coy up-and-down fragment. Helen sighing like the lovesick kid she was. Ruse joining us with a drifty smile. Some teenage boy I didn't know, looking at us all with grateful awe. And no one even had to speak. The silence was knit with so much. I prepared inwardly for Russell's advances, but it only happened after a while. Russell giving me a cryptic nod, so I knew to follow him. I'd been washing windows with Suzanne in the main house, the floor littered with the crumple of newspaper and vinegar, the transistor radio going. Even chores took on the delight of truancy. Suzanne singing along, talking to me with happy, fitful distraction. She looked different those times we worked together, like she forgot herself and relaxed into the girl she was. It's strange to remember she was just 19. When Russell nodded at me, I looked at her reflexively, for permission or forgiveness, either one. The ease in her face had drained into a brittle mask. Scrubbing the warped window with new concentration, she shrugged goodbye when I left, like she didn't mind, though I could sense her watchful gaze on my back. Every time Russell nodded at me like that, my heart contracted, despite the strangeness. I was eager for our encounters, eager to cement my place among them, as if doing what Suzanne did was a way of being with her. Russell never fucked me. It was always other stuff. His fingers moving in me with a technical remove I ascribed to his purity. His aims were elevated, I told myself, unsullied by primitive concerns. "Look at yourself," he said, whenever he sensed shame or hesitance, pointing me toward the fogged mirror in the trailer. "Look at your body. It's not some stranger's body," he said evenly. When I shied away, goofing some excuse, he took me by the shoulders and pointed me back at the mirror. "It's you," he said. "It's Evie. Nothing in you but beauty." The words worked on me, even if only temporarily. A trance overtaking me when I saw my reflection. The scooped breasts, even the soft stomach, the legs rough with mosquito bites. There was nothing to figure out, no complicated puzzles, just the obvious fact of the moment, the only place where love really existed. Afterward, he'd hand me a towel to clean myself, and this seemed like a great kindness. When I returned to her purview, there was always a brief period when Suzanne was cool to me. Even her movements were stiff, as if braced, a lull behind her eyes, like someone asleep at the wheel. I learned quickly how to compliment her, how to ride by her side until she forgot to be aloof and deigned to pass her cigarette to me. It would occur to me later that Suzanne missed me when I left, her formality a clumsy disguise, though it's hard to tell. Maybe that is only a wishful explanation. The other parts of the ranch flash in and out. Guy's black dog, that they called by a rotating series of names. The wanderers who passed through the ranch that summer, crashing for a day or two before leaving. Denizens of the brainless dream, appearing at all hours of the day with woven backpacks and their parents' cars. I didn't see anything familiar in how quickly Russell talked them out of their possessions, put them on the spot, so their generosity became a forced theater. They handed over pink slips to cars, bank books, once even a gold wedding ring, with the stunned and exhausted relief of a drowning person finally giving in to the tidal suck. I was distracted by their tales of sorrow, both harrowing and banal, complaints of evil fathers and cruel mothers, a similarity to the stories that made us all feel like victims of the same conspiracy. It was one of the few days it rained that summer, and most of us were indoors, the old parlor smelling damp and gray, like the air outside. Blankets gridded the floor. I could hear a baseball game on the radio in the kitchen, rain dropping into the plastic bucket under a leak. Ruse was giving Suzanne a hand massage, their fingers slick with lotion, while I read a years-old magazine. My horoscope from March 1967. An irritated sulk hung between us. We were not used to limitations, to being stuck anywhere. The kids did better at being indoors. They passed only briefly through our watch, trundling by on their private missions. There was the bang of a fallen chair in the other room, but no one got up to investigate. Besides Nico, I didn't know who most of the other kids belonged to. All of them were thin-wristed, like they'd gone to seed, powdered milk glazed around their mouths. I'd watched Nico for Ruse a few times, had held him in my arms, and felt his sweaty, pleasing weight. I combed his hair with my fingers, untangled his shark-tooth necklace. All those self-consciously maternal tasks, tasks that pleased me more than him, and allowed me to imagine I alone had the power to make him calm. Nico was uncooperative with these moments of softness, breaking the spell bluntly, like he'd sensed my good feelings and resented them, tugging his little penis at me, demanding juice in a shrieking falsetto, once hitting me so hard that I bruised. I watched him squat and take a shit out on the concrete by the pool, shits we'd sometimes hose away, and sometimes not. Helen wandered downstairs in a Snoopy t-shirt and two big socks, the red heels bunched around her ankles.
"Anyone want to play liar's dice?"
"Nah," Suzanne announced. For all of us, it was assumed. Helen slumped into a balding armchair, stripped of cushions. She glanced at the ceiling.
"Still leaking," she said.
Everyone ignored her.
"Can someone roll a joint?"
she said.
"Please?"
When no one answered, she joined Ruse and Suzanne on the floor.
"Please, please, please,"
she said, nuzzling her head into Ruse's shoulder, draping herself in her lap like a dog.
"Oh, just do it," Suzanne said.
Helen jumped up to get the fake ivory box they kept the supplies in, while Suzanne rolled her eyes at me. I smiled back. It wasn't so bad, I thought, being inside. All of us huddled in the same room like Red Cross survivors, water boiling on the stove for tea. Ruse working by the window, where the light was alabaster through the scrappy lace curtain. The calm was cut by Nico's sudden whine, stamping into the room as he chased a little girl with a bowl cut. She had Nico's shark-tooth necklace, and a yelping scrabble broke out between them. Tears, clawing.
"Hey,"
Suzanne said without looking up, and the kids got quiet, though they kept staring hotly at each other, breathing hard like drunks. Everything seemed fine, quickly handled, until Nico scratched the girl's face, raking her with his overgrown nails, and the screaming doubled. The girl clapped both hands over her cheek, wailing so her baby teeth showed, sustaining a high note of misery. Ruse got to her feet with effort.
"Baby," she said, holding her arms out. "Baby, you gotta be nice."
She took a few steps toward Nico, who started screaming too, sitting down heavy on his diaper.
"Get up," Ruse said. "Come on, baby."
Trying to hold on to his shoulders, but he'd gone limp and wouldn't be moved. The other girl sobered in the face of Nico's antics, how he wrenched away from his mother and started banging his head against the floor.
"Baby," Ruse said, droning louder. "No, no, no."
But he kept going, his eyes getting dark and buttony with pleasure.
"God,"
Helen laughed, a strange laugh that persisted. I didn't know what to do. I remembered the helpless panic I'd sometimes felt when babysitting, a realization that this child did not belong to me and was beyond my reach. But even Ruse seemed paralyzed with the same worry, like she was waiting for Nico's real mother to come home and fix everything. Nico was getting pink with effort, his skull knocking on the floor, yelling until he heard the footsteps on the porch. It was Russell, and I saw everyone's faces condense with new life.
"What's this?" Russell said.
He was wearing one of Mitch's cast-off shirts, big bloody roses embroidered along the yoke. He was barefoot, wet all over from the rain.
"Ask Ruse," Helen chirped. "It's her kid."
Ruse muttered something, her words going wild at the end, but Russell didn't respond on her level. His voice was calm, seeming to draw a circle around the crying child, the flustered mother.
"Relax," Russell intoned.
He wouldn't let anyone's upset in, the jitter in the room deflected by his gaze. Even Nico looked wary in Russell's presence, his tantrum taking on a hollow cast, like he was an understudy for himself.
"Little man," Russell said, "come on up here and talk to me."
Nico glared at his mother, but his eyes were drawn, helpless, to Russell. Nico pushed out his fat bottom lip, calculating. Russell stayed standing in the doorway, not bending down, eager and wet-toothed, like some grown-ups did with kids. And Nico was mostly quiet, settling into a whimper, darting another look between his mother and Russell, before finally scurrying over to Russell and letting himself be picked up.
"There's the little man," Russell said,
Nico's arms clinging tight around his neck. And I remember how strange it was to see Russell's face change as he talked to the boy. His features mutable, turning antic and foolish, like a jester's, though his voice stayed calm. He could do that. Change himself to fit the person, like water taking on the shape of whatever vessel it was poured into. He could be all these things at once. The man who crooked his fingers in me. The man who got everything free. The man who sometimes fucked Suzanne hard and sometimes fucked her gently. The man who whispered to the little boy, his voice grazing his ear. I couldn't hear what Russell said, but Nico swallowed his crying. His face was thrilled and wet. He seemed happy just to be in someone's arms. Helen's 11-year-old cousin, Caroline, ran away from home and stayed for a while. She'd been living in the Hate, but there had been a police crackdown. She'd hitched to the ranch with a cowhide wallet and a ratty fox fur coat she petted with skittish affection, like she didn't want anyone to see how much she loved it. The ranch wasn't that far from San Francisco, but we didn't go there very often. I'd gone only once with Suzanne, to pick up a pound of grass from a house she called, jokingly, the Russian Embassy. Some friends of Guy's, I think. The old Satanist hangout. The front door was painted a tarry black. She saw my hesitation and hooked her arm through mine.
"Do me, huh?" she said. I thought so, too, at first.
When she hitched me closer, I felt the knock of her hip bones. These moments of kindness were never anything but dazzling to me. Afterward, she and I walked over to Hippie Hill. It was grayed out and drizzling, empty except for the undead stumbling of junkies. I tried hard to squeeze out a vibe from the air, but there was nothing. I was relieved when Suzanne laughed, too, halting any labor for meaning.
"Jesus," she said, "this place is a dump."
We ended up back in the park, the fog dripping audibly from the eucalyptus leaves. I spent almost every day at the ranch, except for brief stopovers at my house to change clothes or leave notes on the kitchen table for my mother. Notes that I'd sign, "Your loving daughter," indulging the overblown affection my absence made room for. I knew I was starting to look different, the weeks at the ranch working me over with a grubby wash, my hair getting light from the sun and sharp at the edges, a tint of smoke lingering even after I shampooed. Much of my clothes had passed into the ranch possession, morphing into garments I often failed to recognize as my own. Helen clowning around in my once precious bib shirt, now torn and spotted with peach juice. I dressed like Suzanne, a raunchy patchwork culled from the communal piles, clothes whose scrappiness announced a hostility to the larger world. I had gone with Suzanne to the home market once, Suzanne wearing a bikini top and cutoffs, and we'd watched the other shoppers glare and grow hot with indignation, their sideways glances becoming outright stares. We'd laughed with insane, helpless snorts, like we'd had some wild secret, and we had. The woman, who'd seemed about to cry with baffled disgust, clutching for her daughter's arm. She hadn't known her hatred only made us more powerful. I prepared for possible sightings of my mother with pious ablutions. I showered, standing in the hot water until my skin splotched red, my hair slippery with conditioner. I put on a plain t-shirt and white cotton shorts, what I might have worn when I was younger, trying to appear scrubbed and sexless enough to comfort my mother. Though maybe I didn't need to try so hard. She wasn't looking closely enough to warrant the effort. The times we did have dinner together, a mostly silent affair, she would fuss at her food like a picky child, inventing reasons to talk about Frank, inane weather reports from her own life. I could have been anyone. One night I didn't bother to change, showing up at the table in a voile halter top that showed my stomach. She didn't say anything, plowing her spoon through her rice with a distracted air until she seemed suddenly to remember my presence, darting a slanted look at me. "You're getting so skinny," she announced, gripping my wrist and letting it drop in jealous measurement. I shrugged, and she didn't bring it up again. When I finally met him in person, Mitch Lewis was fatter than I expected someone famous to be, swollen, like there was butter under his skin. His face was furred with sideburns, his feathered golden hair. He brought a case of root beer for the girls and 6 netted bags of oranges, stale brownies with German chocolate frosting in individual frilled cups like pilgrims' bonnets, nougat candy in bright pink tins, the dregs of gift baskets, I assumed, a carton of cigarettes. "He knows I like this kind," Suzanne said, hugging the cigarettes to her chest. "He remembered." They all spoke of Mitch with that possessiveness, like he was an idea more than an actual person. They'd preened and prepared for Mitch's visit with girlish eagerness. "You can see the ocean from his hot tub," Suzanne told me. "Mitch put lights up, so the water is all glowy." "His dick is really big," Donna added, "and like purple." Donna was washing her armpits in the sink, and Suzanne rolled her eyes. "Horse bath," she murmured, but she changed into a dress. Even Russell slicked back his hair with water, giving him a polished, urbane air. Russell introduced me to Mitch, saying, "Our little actress," his hand at my back. Mitch studied me with a questioning, smug smile. Men did it so easily, that immediate parceling of value, and how they seemed to want you to collude on your own judgment. "I'm Mitch," he said, as if I hadn't already known. His skin was fresh-looking and poreless in the way of wealthy overeaters. "Give Mitch a hug," Russell said, nudging me. "Mitch wants a hug, just like the rest of us. He could use a little love." Mitch looked expectant, opening a present he'd already shaken and identified. Usually, I would have been eaten by shyness, conscious of my body, some error I could make. But already I felt different. I was one of them, and that meant I could smile back at Mitch, stepping forward to let him mash himself against me. The long afternoon that followed, Mitch and Russell took turns playing guitar, Helen sitting on Mitch's lap in a bikini top. She kept giggling and ducking her pigtailed head into his neck. Mitch was a much better musician than Russell, but I tried not to notice. I got stoned with a new and furious concentration, passing beyond the point of nervousness and into a blunted state, smiling almost involuntarily so my cheeks started to ache. Suzanne sat cross-legged in the dirt beside me, her fingers grazing mine, our faces cupped and attentive as tulips. It was one of those slurry days we offered up to the shared dream, a violence in our aversion to real life. Though it was all about connecting, tuning in, we told ourselves. Mitch had dropped off some acid, sourced from a lab tech at Stanford. Donna mixed it with orange juice in paper cups, and we drank it for breakfast, so the trees seemed to thrum with energy, the shadows purpling and wet. It was curious later to think of how easily I fell into things. If there were drugs around, I did them. You were in the moment, when everything back then happened. We could talk about the moment for hours, turn it over in conversation, the way the light moved, why someone was silent, dismantling all the layers of what a look had really meant. It seemed like something important, our desire to describe the shape of each second as it passed, to bring out everything hidden and beat it to death. Suzanne and I were working on the childish bracelets the girls had been trading among ourselves, collecting them up our arms like middle schoolers, practicing the V-stitch, the candy stripe. I was making one for Suzanne, fat and wide, a poppy red chevron on a field of peach thread. I liked the calm collection of the knots, how the colors vibrated happily under my fingers. I got up once to get Suzanne a glass of water, and there was a domestic gentleness in that act. I wanted to meet a need, put water in her mouth. Suzanne smiled up at me as she drank, gulping so fast I could see her throat ripple. Helen's cousin Caroline was hanging around that day. She seemed more knowing than I had ever been at 11. Her bracelets shook with the kiss of cheap metal. Her terry cloth shirt was the pale yellow of a lemon slushy and showed her small stomach, though her knees were scraped and ashy like a boy's.
"Far out,"
she said when Guy tipped a paper cup of juice to her lips, and like a wind-up toy, she kept repeating this phrase when the acid began to hit. I'd started to detect the first signs in myself, too, my mouth filling with saliva. I thought of the flooded creeks I'd seen in childhood, the death cold of the rainwater as it came swift over the rocks. I could hear Guy spinning nonsense on the porch, one of his meaningless stories, the drug making his bluster echo, his long hair pulled into a dark knot at the base of his skull. "This fellow was banging on the door," he was saying, "shouting that he'd come to take what was his, and I was like, 'Aw, hell, big fucking deal,'" he droned. "I'm Elvis Presley." And Ruse was nodding along, squinting up at the sun while Country Joe sounded from the house. Clouds drifting across the blue, outlined in neon. "Check out Orphan Annie," Suzanne said, rolling her eyes at Caroline. Caroline was overdoing it at first, her stumbling dopey effect. But soon, the drug actually caught up to her and she got wild-eyed and a little scared. She was thin enough that I could see the glandular throb at her throat. Suzanne was watching her too, and I waited for her to say something, but she didn't. Helen, Caroline's supposed cousin, didn't say anything either. She was sunstruck, catatonic, stretched out on a piece of old carpet, and listing a hand over her eyes, giggling to no one. I went over to Caroline finally, touching her tiny shoulder.
"How's it going?" I said.
She didn't look up until I said her name. I asked her where she was from. She screwed her eyes tight. It was the wrong thing to say, of course it was, bringing up all that bad shit from the outside, whatever rotten memories were probably doubling right then. I didn't know how to pull her back from the bog.
"You want this?"
I said, holding up the bracelet. She peeked at it.
"Just have to finish it," I said. "But it's for you."
Caroline smiled.
"It's gonna look real nice on you," I went on. "It'll go good with your shirt."
The electricity in her eyes calmed. She held her own shirt away from her body to study it, softening.
"I made it," she said, fingering the embroidered outline of a peace sign on the shirt,
and I saw the hours she'd spent on it,
maybe borrowing her mother's sewing box. It seemed easy to be kind to her, to put the finished bracelet around her wrist, burning the knot with a match so she'd have to cut it off. I didn't notice Suzanne eyeing us, her own bracelet ignored in her lap.
"Beautiful," I said, lifting Caroline's wrist. "Nothing but beauty."
As if I were an occupant of that world, someone who could show the way to others. Such grandiosity mixed up in my feelings of kindness. I was starting to fill in all the blank spaces in myself with the certainties of the ranch. The cool glut of Russell's words, "No more ego. Turn off the mind. Pick up the cosmic wind instead." Our beliefs as mild and digestible as the sweet rolls and cakes we hustled from a bakery in Sausalito, stuffing our faces with the easy starch. In the days after, Caroline followed me like a stray dog, hovering in the doorway of Suzanne's room, asking if I wanted one of the cigarettes she'd cadged from the bikers. Suzanne stood up and clasped her elbows behind her back, stretching.
"They just gave you them," Suzanne said archly. "For free?"
Caroline glanced at me.
"The cigarettes?"
Suzanne laughed without saying anything else. I was confused in these moments, but translated them into further proof. Suzanne was prickly with other people because they didn't understand her, like I did. I didn't say it out loud to myself, or even think about it too much, where things were heading with Suzanne. The dredge of discomfort I got when she disappeared with Russell. How I didn't know what to do without her, seeking out Donna or Ruse, like a lost kid. The time she came back smelling of dried sweat, and roughly wiped herself between the legs with a washcloth, like she didn't care I was watching. I got up when I saw how nervously Caroline fingered the bracelet I'd given her.
"I'll take a cigarette," I said, smiling at Caroline.
Suzanne hooked her arm in mine.
"But we're gonna feed the llamas," Suzanne said. "Don't want them to starve, do you? Waste away."
I hesitated, and Suzanne reached out to play with a part of my hair. She was always doing that, picking burrs off my shirt, once wedging a fingernail between my front teeth to dislodge a bit of food, breaching the boundaries to let me know they didn't exist. Caroline's desire to be invited was so blatant that I felt almost ashamed. But it didn't stop me from following Suzanne outside, shrugging an apology at Caroline. I could feel her watching us go. The hooded attentions of a child, that wordless understanding. I saw that disappointment was already something familiar to Caroline. I was scanning the contents of my mother's refrigerator, the glass jars mortared with dried spills, the fumes of cruciferous vegetables roiling in plastic bags. Nothing to eat, as usual. Little things like this reminded me why I'd rather be somewhere else. When I heard my mother shuffling in the front door, the razzle of her heavy jewelry, I tried to slink off without crossing paths.
"Evie," she called, coming into the kitchen. "Wait up a minute."
I was out of breath from the bike ride from the ranch, and at the tail end of being stoned. I tried to blink an ordinary number of times to present a blank face that would give her nothing.
"You're getting so tan," she said, lifting my arm, and I shrugged.
She idly brushed the hair on my arm back and forth, then paused. There was an uncomfortable moment between us. It occurred to me she'd finally caught on to the trickle of money that had been disappearing. The thought of her anger didn't scare me. The act had been so preposterous that it took on the safety of the unreal. I'd almost started to believe that I had never really lived here, so strong was the feeling of disassociation as I crept through the house on my errands for Suzanne. My excavation of my mother's underwear drawer,
sifting through the tea-colored silks and pilly lace until I closed in on a roll of bills banded with a hair tie. My mother furrowed her brows. "Listen," she said. "Sal saw you out on Adobe Road this morning. Alone." I tried to keep my face blank, but I was relieved. It was just one of Sal's bovine observations. I'd been telling my mother I'd been at Connie's house, and I was still home some nights, trying to keep the balance in check.
"Sal said there's some very strange people out there," my mother said. "Some kind of mystic or something. But he sounds..." Her face screwed up.
Of course, she would love Russell if he lived in a mansion in Marin, had gardenias floating in his pool, and charged rich women $50 for an astrology reading. How transparent she seemed to me then, always on constant guard against anything lesser than, even as she opened the house up to anyone who smiled at her, to Frank and his shiny buttoned shirts.
"I've never met him," I said, my voice impassive, so my mother would know I was lying.
The fact of the lie hovered there, and I watched her till for a response.
"I just wanted to warn you," she said, "so you know that this guy is out there. I expect you and Connie to take care of each other. Understand?" I could see how badly she wanted to avoid a fight, how she strained for this middle ground. She'd warned me, so she had done what she was supposed to do. It meant she was still my mother. Let her feel this was true. I nodded, and she relaxed. My mother's hair was growing out. She was wearing a new tank top with knit straps, and the skin of her shoulders was loose, showing a tan line from a swimsuit. I had no idea when or where my mother had been swimming. How quickly we'd become strangers to each other, like nervous roommates encountering each other in the halls.
"Well," she said. I saw for a moment my old mother, the cast of weary love in her face, but it disappeared when her bracelets made a tinny sound, falling down her arms.
"There's rice and miso in the fridge," she said, and I made a noise in my throat like I might eat it, but we both knew I wouldn't.